Happy Sabbath, everyone. To all those listening in, hopefully my kids are listening in. They said they were, but I no longer have control over them. So, Sophia is in Spain, Garrison is in Flagstaff, and Nicholas is in San Diego. So, maybe two out of the three might be listening. Okay, Sam, are we good? Oh, there we go. Okay. How fragile is your identity? Brian spoke about essentially identity, working together, knowing what your role is in the church, and God knows what our identity is and what our role is. I'm going to be speaking about how fragile is that. And so to do that, I'm going to be talking about, well, I'll step back. My wife and I and Sophia, we've traveled the past month in February to different parts of the world. And I, as you know, Scott, how fragile identities are in different parts of the world, and how sometimes that relates to personal identity. So I'd like to start off with some national identities and how fragile I am, and make some inferences personally. And then at the end, we'll talk about people in the Bible, their identity, what they struggled with, and how they coped with it. So, how fragile is your identity? First of all, let's have a definition of identity. Identity refers to our sense of who we are as individuals and as members of a social group. It also refers to our sense of how others may perceive us and label us. So anytime our identity is concerned about what other people think of us, it's going to be fragile by nature. At least that portion of it's going to be. Now, I've heard identity described like a tree. You have the roots of your identity, the core of your identity, the trunk, and then you have the branches and leaves. Our identities are always changing through our experiences and through our relationships and through different course of action. What we need to be careful of is that our roots are strong and foundational, and we don't get those confused with the leaves and the trees. I mean, not the leaves and the branches. So on a personal level, I grew up in a strong family, which was good. Rock solid. My roots and my family were great. But as I went to school, not so much. How I was perceived by my peers, a little bit fragile. So I think maybe fourth or fifth grade, there's field day. And I raced, and I happened to win whatever race it was, the 50-yard dash. And so that's what I became known as. I was fast. You know, I won the race. Well, so I took that on, and that made me feel good. But it also wanted me to make me protect that identity. So people would challenge me throughout the year, do you want to race? And I thought, well, I have nothing to gain except lose my status as the fastest person. So no, I don't want to race. So next year comes along, and then there's a field day, and I lose because I don't have any practice. So I think it's important to be careful of protecting that identity too much, because we all need to learn and we all need to grow. So I want to get back to the national and regional level. Lisa and I and Sophia went to the Balkans. And anybody who knows the Balkans knows it's a powder keg of different cultures, ideas, religions. Fascinating, sad in a lot of aspects, but encouraging in others. And I'd like to talk about the dynamics of what's going on there, what has gone on there, and see if we can't get some spiritual lessons from it. Vlade Divac, he was a Serbian basketball player. He played for the Lakers in the 90s. He described the people of the Balkans as this. The people of the Balkans are like a dysfunctional family. We may fight and argue, but in the end, we are family. So that may be overly optimistic compared to what's going on now, but I guess I would argue that the family falls apart if there's no parents involved, and that's kind of what's happening there now. So for those of you, let's go back and figure out why the Balkans are the way they are. We can go back as far as you want, but let's start with the Romans because they were involved with everything at one point in time. So that's the starting point. And then I'd like to talk about the great schism between Catholic Church and Orthodox Church, which dramatically affect what's going on in the Balkans region. Let's see if this arrow works. Can you see this? It's really big on my screen. This is the Balkans region right here. It's kind of on it bordered Orthodox and Catholic faiths, which had an effect on that area. There's a battle of ideas. One specific area, Bosnia-Herzegovina, was labeled by both Catholics and Orthodox as heretical. And we can go through why or all the different reasons why they were. But suffice to say, they didn't fit in to any of them, mostly because nobody really paid attention to them. They were just there, and the Orthodox thought the Catholics were taking it. The Catholics thought the Orthodox. So they just kind of were left there to grow kind of their own sect, own religion. Here's the current state of the Balkans and the countries that are there now. And they all have their different cultures, flavors, whatnot. Most of it used to be former Yugoslavia. Slovenia, Croatia, Bosnia-Herzegovina, Serbia, Montenegro, Kosovo, Macedonia. Those are all former. Albania was never part of former Yugoslavia, but it has its own characteristics as well, which we'll go into. So the Ottoman Empire. This region has been back and forth between empires and ideas for, you know, as long as anybody can remember. So the Ottomans had success pushing up through the Balkans because they were a breath of fresh air, to be honest with you, compared to what the Catholics and Orthodox were doing. They were heavy-handed about it. The Ottomans came in and said, no, you don't have to convert to Islam. You'll have less taxes if you do. So that's good. So they were kind of, it was a little bit softer approach. And it really took hold in some of these areas because of that softer approach. Then we have the Austro-Hungarian Empire, which started pushing back the Ottoman Empire late 1800s. And of course, they pushed back with their own culture and essentially Catholicism, if you're going to tie it to a religion, pushing back down through the Balkans. And especially, as you can see, Sarajevo and Belgrade, right on the edges of that influence. Which brings me to the start of World War I, which is essentially started in Sarajevo with the assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand by a Serb national. And is essentially, you know, Serbia wanting to be independent of a foreign power. The whole region had been conquered by people who never really were from there. So Serbia was like, well, we want to be on our own. So that caused World War I. Central powers, Austria, Hungary, Bulgaria, Germany, and the Ottoman Empire aligned. And Serbia, Montenegro, France, the United Kingdom, Russia, Italy, and later Greece were the allies. So fast forward, World War II, there was a leader named Joseph Broz Tito, which is in that region of the world. He's somebody that's part of their culture. He essentially started Yugoslavia as we know it. But he was a partisan that essentially kicked out the Nazis. So he is heralded there. Now, Joseph, as he was consolidating Yugoslavia, well, he was communist, so the Russians were okay with it. they came up with the name Yugoslavia. I think it was actually before that. But Yugoslavia just means Yugo, which is southern, and Slav, which is the type of people they are. Yugoslavia. And so he made a statement. I am the leader of one country which has two alphabets, three languages, four religions, five nationalities, six republics, surrounded by seven neighbors, a country in which there are eight ethnic minorities. So he was able to keep it all together through, well, communism kind of overrides all those things, right? It was kind of put on, tamped down. And he was brutal, but when you go there, there's mixed reactions to his regime because the economy was actually pretty good during his reign. And they didn't have problems with each other, with all of the multiculturalism that they had. He was able to play America and Russia to benefit the country. USA came to there because the U.S. wanted to show the rest of the world how a communist country could kind of become capitalist. It never really worked under Tito, but interesting side fact, a third of their GDP in Yugoslavia was to build Tito's nuclear bunker, which was quite amazing. It was just vast, and so yeah, he was a shrewd politician, and was able to play other countries and enrich Yugoslavia. When he died, obviously there's a power vacuum. Yugoslavia got in debt. And looked for outside money. IMF came in there, gave them money. They kept getting more and more in debt because inefficiencies of a communist economy. Essentially, IMF sort of, depending how you want to look at it, kind of pushed them into democracy. And democracy is great if it's based on protecting minorities, and it wasn't here. So now with a democracy in this kind of region, you essentially have mob rule, which is exactly what happened. As you would have votes, you would have people that, well, after communism fell, which was a shared goal, they were looking for an identity. Who are they? So they started going back to what they were before communism, which was whatever ethnic group they were in, which whatever. You know, split into a million pieces, that became their identity because they had an identity crisis. Communism kind of spurred on this, and capitalism sort of kind of broke what they had there, the glue that held them together. Now, specifically Bosnia, so when it broke up, let me see if I have it here. I may have to go back. Sorry. Okay. So the first people to go were Slovenia and Croatia, and they left. They were the richest part of former Yugoslavia, and they didn't want to be burdened. They didn't want to be bogged down by the poorer parts of Yugoslavia. So they said, "We want independence." And Serbia became the protectors of the former Yugoslavia. That's where all the army, that's where everything was. So that was their role, of being the protectors of keeping it all together. They didn't fight too hard with Slovenia because obviously they're fairly far away from Serbia. Croatia, a little bit harder. As it got down to Bosnia-Herzegovina, that's where all the horror story, that's what you see. The huge battles, and let me see here. This is interesting when it comes to religions in the region. All the red here is Orthodox. The green is Islam, Sunni Muslims, and the brown over here is Catholic. These are all remnants of whatever empire was there before, but they still had an identity in that region. And this is how. And so Bosnia-Herzegovina is a mix of Orthodox and Islam and a little bit of Croatian Catholics. So, one of the longest sieges of a city in modern times was Sarajevo, because Sarajevo was the capital of Bosnia-Herzegovina. Bosnian Serbs attacked it for 4 years. And Sarajevo was a city that was multicultural, still is multicultural. And what's interesting, when you see the people who died there, they come from all nationalities. There are Serbians that defended the city, Muslims, Croats. They all wanted to protect that. They wanted to protect that city because it was a city that worked for them. Well, the Serb nationals from Serbia didn't want to let that go. So all kinds of atrocities happened there. So now Bosnia-Herzegovina is set up into three different regions with three different presidents. Massively dysfunctional. We drove through it. We liked Sarajevo, but it's quite obvious there's just no way this country can survive without UN intervention and oversight, which, I mean, how long does that go on for? There's still massive tension in that area. So what's the spiritual lesson to learn from Bosnia-Herzegovina? For Serbia, there was a mix of nationalism and Orthodox religion that became their identity. And so I'm getting ahead of myself. For Bosnia-Herzegovina, the spiritual lesson, if there are no roots to your identity, your life will be in turmoil. And that's what's going on there now. The country's in turmoil. Now let's move on to Serbia, which I said was kind of the protectors of former Yugoslavia. For the Serbians, they mix nationalism and Orthodox. They kind of go hand in hand. So if you know anything about Orthodox religion and Catholicism, there is no pope in the Orthodox religion. It's very much national. You have the Greek Orthodox Church. You have the Serbian Orthodox Church, Russian Orthodox Church. So it's much more easy to tie that religion in with nationalism or any sort of country. So that's kind of what went on here. Interestingly enough, Russia or Putin has used, you know, former KGB agent. Now he's champion of Orthodox Church because he's seen that's how you influence people. Communism's gone, so he's the de facto defender of the Orthodox faith. And recently, the building on the left is a basilica in Belgrade called. I think it's St. Sava. I got a little away from... Oh, Church of St. Sava. It's in Belgrade. Anyways, it's one of the few churches I've seen in Europe where they were still actively working on it. You don't see that anywhere else. So I was intrigued by it. Well, they're still working on it because the country actually supports it. Russia donated $10 million to the church to do the murals on the inside. So it's an interesting kind of way that Russia and Putin want to maintain control or some sort of influence on that area. It's modeled after Hagia Sophia. Oh, it got cut off a little bit. Well, half of Hagia Sophia in Istanbul, which was the epicenter of the Orthodox faith for a while. It may still be there. That's a whole other story of what's going on there now. But let me go back one. I'm ahead of myself. What lessons to be learned? Lessons to be learned from Serbia. If your identity is based on forcing your viewpoints on others, you won't be as effective as you hoped. Yeah. So they found themselves. They want forced people to come together. Well, people weren't having it. Leads me to Albania, which is never part of Yugoslavia. Just said it's quite fascinating. Albania, 90% Muslim before communism. So. The communist dictator that was there, which wasn't a part of Russia, wasn't even part of Yugoslavia, his name was Enver Hoxha. And he thought he had a brand of communism that was more pure than the Russians. So he severed ties with them. More pure than the Yugoslavians. So he essentially isolated himself from them. China comes in, and they try to have dealings with, well, China wasn't communist enough for them. So what they did was close themselves off. They became the North Korea of Europe. And there was 170,000 of these bunkers that are placed all throughout the country because of the paranoia that someone was going to infiltrate or leave or somehow taint their brand of communism. Fascinating and sad, but that's what happened there. So spiritual lesson from Albania. Don't have your identity so tied up in an ideology that your sole purpose is to protect it and close yourself off from the rest of the world. If you viewed yourself as being the best communist, why didn't you try to spread it? Not that I would have appreciated that, but I mean, that would be the logical conclusion. Enver Hoxha died in 1985. Albania is now a member of NATO, looking to be their candidate for EU. They don't actually have the same tensions as Bosnia-Herzegovina because they're primarily Muslim. So it's a little easier in that sense. And they're not fundamentalists, really. They're by culture, I would say, in that region. So during this time of all this going on in the Balkans, me and even Brian alluded to it, we had our own personal crisis with the Worldwide Church of God falling apart. That was a root of who I was. And so that was difficult to get over, to find out, well, without the roots of my, who am I? And that takes a long time to heal and figure out. So let's look at a present day crisis. And this is a crisis that's going on everywhere else in the world. It's a crisis of identity. It's a crisis of ideas. Recently, there was a book called The Identity Trap by Professor Yasa Monk. And he describes how the well-meaning push to appreciate the culture and heritage of minority groups has turned into an obsession. And if you look around, you can see that obsession being played out over and over again. Postmodernism, post-colonialism, and CRT forged the identity synthesis / wokeness, whatever you want to call it, that conquered many colleges' campuses by 2010. And I know we have some college people here, and maybe you can chime in to see how that's going. Maybe I'm off base. But maybe you can give your opinions. There are groups out there whose ideas aim to replace the root of people's identity with the obsession with group identity. They don't want to add branches to a person's tree. They don't want to expand identity. They want to replace it. They want to replace the identity and say that these things are the most important parts of your identity. And you could go one side, but I would say Donald Trump and what he's doing is a backlash to that. You know, he's like Putin in the regard that he's aligned himself with the Christian right, even though he does not appear to be a Christian at all. He has no empathy. He has no compassion. But he does it to control people. It's for power. So in that sense, Trump is a backlash to the other backlash of people's identity and convincing people that that's the most, or convincing all these different immutable characteristics of their identity are the most important things in their life. So I'd like to come back with a personal example. My parents are deaf. My dad's deaf. And there's two different ways to look. There's two different camps in the deaf community, as I was talking about. There's deaf with a capital D, which is a very inclusive, you're always around deaf people. That's where you're safe, and that's where you're going to know who you are. And there's deaf with a D, which you are deaf. It doesn't define who you are. It is a part of who you are. It is not the most important part of your identity. My dad chose deaf with the little D. He is deaf. That didn't define everything about him. He became an engineer, provided a good standard of living. We had a great childhood. So I'm thankful for that, that he wasn't convinced to change his identity and become tribal like we all tend to do and surround by something like that. So let's look at some biblical examples. of identity. If you'll turn with me to Mark 9, 38 through 40, I'll read from New International Version. So we see in the Bible that tribalism was alive and well with the apostles. "Teacher," said John, "we saw someone driving out demons in your name, and we told him to stop, because he was not one of us. He was not one of our tribe." So forget the fact that he's not up. He's not one of us. He's not our tribe. Not a part of our group. They're doing something good. Christ says, "Well, do not stop him." Jesus said, "For no one who does a miracle in my name can in the next moment say anything bad about me. For whoever is not against us is for us." And I think that's an important concept to realize, to hedge yourself against tribalism. Whoever is not against us is for us. Yes, they're not a part of our group. They're doing something good. They are not our enemy. So what about the Apostle Paul? We know that he had an identity crisis. He was a Pharisee. He persecuted the Christians. Came to a head on the road to Damascus, and he converted to Christianity. He was a big proponent of it. But did he get away from his identity of being Jewish? Did he get away from his identity of being Roman? No, he did not. He was a Jew, he was a Christian, and he was a Roman. If you turn with me to 1 Corinthians 9, 20 through 22, New International Version. Verse 20, excuse me, hang on, I'll take a little break here. "To the Jews, I became like a Jew, to win the Jews. To those under the law, I became like one under the law, although I myself am not under the law, so as to win those under the law. To those not having the law, I became like one not having the law, though I am not free from God's law, but I am under Christ's law, so as to win those not having the law. To the weak, I became weak. And to win the weak, I have become all things to all people, so that by all means I might have some." So that doesn't sound very tribal to me. I think Paul connected different cultures, different people, so that he could have influence on it, so that he could ultimately convert them to Christianity. Let's contrast this with Galatians 3:28 and see if we can't make sense of that. "There is neither Jew nor Gentile, neither slave nor free, nor is there male and female, for you are all one in Christ Jesus." Now, was Paul actually suggesting that these identities don't exist, that there isn't Jews, there's no Gentile? Of course they're there. But what he's saying is that is not the core of your identity. Those are not the roots of your identity. It is part of it, and that doesn't need to be thrown away. But know what the roots of your identity is. So in conclusion, I believe that the roots of a healthy national identity are based on shared values, which this country had for a while, even though it fell short of applying those values. We seem to be at a point where shared values are eroding as identities are weaponized to cause further tribalization. The whole idea of divide and conquer is alive and well. Obviously, for a Christian church, the roots of our identity need to be based in Christ and nothing else. I can't even count the number of splits we've had in worldwide. And we're all weaker for it. Once we define our identities on what makes us different rather than shared values, tribalism inevitably occurs. So where do you stop splitting differences? It keeps going. Once you've gone down that path, I don't believe the Balkans is done. Kosovo has a crisis right now. I don't know how that's going to play out. Once you go down that path, it's just a matter of continuing, tribalizing, and, we can't trust these people. We can't trust these people. The one thing we love about traveling is to see different cultures, ethnicities, I didn't say that right, and different ways people live. We can appreciate who we are and our differences without making it the core of our identity. The leaves and branches of our identity are always changing through loss, circumstances in life, experiences both good and bad. But don't let someone else manipulate into you thinking that the leaves and branches of your identity are your roots.